first and foremost, the Uganda Investment Authority is always going to protect the investor at all costs. And also, when you look at our Investment Code Act, it says that the government shall always make land available to the investor. Land is like one of the biggest means of production in Uganda, and that is what the government of Uganda can offer best. But why do we support the investors? Is because we previously, like I explained, the different entities do have different interests, and everybody has to protect their interests. Yes. You know, and secondly is sometimes even the investor is just a face of a bigger investment than we actually think. There is undercover information that the community probably does not know, and neither do we know as civil society organizations. So you find that it is even hard to even think that you know, the government would side with them. But sometimes it's because of the different, you know, different interests of various people within the project. Secondly, it's also sometimes when you're impoverished, there is a way society looks at you. We have realized that most of the communities that are infected, there is a knowledge gap, first of all, in terms of land rights. There is also a knowledge gap in terms of these projects.
This was Sarah from Witness Radio, who explained how conflicts over land arise and how you may avoid being affected by land conflicts or hold investors or government entities accountable. We will talk about free prior informed consent, and we will talk about judicial and non-judicial redress mechanisms and legal tools that actually might work in case of injustices. What can people do to hold government authorities and investors accountable? How can they file a complaint? These are the main topics of our third episode. Stay tuned.
All these investments, when they come to Uganda, they all talk about we are coming to develop the country. So when community members see such investments coming, they expect development, because it's not like every investment that is going to come is going to evict people and leave, you know, the land with only the investment going on. Some of these investments take just a piece of land, and then there are community members that still stay in the community. So it would be for something to look beautiful, you know. When an investment is happening in a community, let it develop the community. Let people feel its presence. Let them feel its importance, you know. Let them feel, yeah, it was good for this project to come, or for this investment to come in our community, you get. So it would be very good for investors to know that whenever they are trying to invest in a given community, let them try to change the lives of the people they are found there. Let them construct schools. Let them have construct hospitals. Make life a bit easier than it was, so that people are able to welcome, you know, the project. But the saddest bit of it is most of them, when they come, they actually leave the community members in a worse state than they were. That is why you see that a lot of people are fighting investors in one or another.
As a financier, you see when such projects are coming in on board, you need to also be human rights you know, sensitive, that in this where this project is going to be based, aren't there people living there? There should be some due diligence that is done by the financier before it even gives, you know, the private sector money or even the investor money to, you know, implement the project.
When the investors are coming in the community, they must consult the community. They must involve them, you know. They must engage them.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices. Witness Radio, your number one choice.
Hello, listeners. This is Know Your Land and Environmental Rights Program. My name is Stephen Mwiri, your show host today. Welcome to the third and last audio tutorial, which aims at protection of local communities' land rights against the increasing irresponsible investments. These tutorials are brought to you by the German-based organization SEZ and IZ3W, based in Freiburg. In our previous episode, we looked at the impacts, both positive and negative, brought by investments in host communities and how they have shaped local communities. In this final episode today, we'll explore how affected communities by such investments can organize, seek justice, and demand accountability from both investors and government officials. Today in our studio, I host two respected human rights lawyers, Sarah Dong and Joanne Bulerari, who have worked closely with communities facing land grabs and forced evictions across Uganda. May you say hi to our listener, Sarah.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for this opportunity, and we hope we have a good deliberation on the matters before us today.
Yes, and join, please.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for staying tuned in to Witness Radio. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear from our guests.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices. Witness Radio, your number one choice.
In Uganda, land is a valuable resource that is necessary for everyone to survive and flourish. So it is equally crucial to comprehend the land laws and policies about its appropriate usage. To learn more, tune in to Witness Radio.
Listen to Witness Radio to stay up to date on breaking news about land evictions in Uganda.
Many thanks to everyone tuning to Witness Radio. We are in our last episode of the audio tutorial. Across Uganda, many communities facing evictions, and sometimes they are told to seek redress. Yet few understand what the process actually involves or how realistic it is. Sarah, when communities are unlawfully evicted or when directives to halt evictions are ignored, where does the journey to justice begin?
Thank you very much for that question, Stephen. Evictions have been on a rampant rise from a decade ago. There has been a lot of evictions. However, we see that it is a vice that is mostly in the central and midwestern parts of Uganda. The eastern parts of Uganda have a few registered evictions, much as they are there as well, but they have registered at least a few evictions. In terms of redress mechanisms, we have national redress mechanisms, we have international redress mechanisms. However, you can only explore the international redress mechanisms if the national mechanisms fail. And that is also dependent on a few projects. Because every project, let's say, is financed by different financing institutions. And within those institutions, you find that they do have accountability mechanisms that these evicted communities can explore. So that is an international redress mechanism. It's much of an alternative dispute resolution processes that they do follow to get redress. When we speak national redress mechanisms, we are speaking courts of law, we are speaking the different entities that probably have a hand in these evictions. For example, Ministry of Lands. You can always approach Ministry of Lands, you can always approach the district, land board, you can always... there are different entities within a district itself, depending on where the eviction is. And you see, the beauty about our Ugandan laws is we have comprehensive land laws that cater for even for the most vulnerable person. We also have tribunals per se. We have a land tribunal in MZONO offices. These are all there that you can, Ministry of Land zonal offices is what I mean by zonal offices. So Ministry of Lands has decentralized their offices to be able to capture the different districts or the different regions within Uganda. So if you cannot come to Kampala, which is at the headquarters, you can always use the zonal offices. These zonal offices do have registrars of land, and there you can also take your complaint, most especially for those that have registered land. Whose land has been obtained through fraudulent registration. You know, there could be challenges within the registration processes or obtaining of certificate of title. You can always approach the Ministry of Land zonal offices to get that title cancelled. Because as a registrar, you have the powers to actually cancel the title. For as long as the person complaining shows that there were inequalities or there was a bit of lack of, they did not follow the right procedure in obtaining that, you know, certificate of title. Mm-hmm. Secondly, is you could also go to the courts of judicature. The courts of judicature, we can start from the magistrates court, in fact, even the local area council courts, because that's where administration of justice starts. We have the local council 1 court, local council 2 court, local council 3, and then from there, if you can also go to chief magistrates court, high court, court of appeal, and Supreme Court. However, the courts of first instances are always the local government courts, High Court and Magistrate Court. Now, the Court of Appeal and Supreme Court, these are only appellant courts. They are not courts of first instances where you take a case for the first time. So if you're taking your case to court for the first time or filing for the first time, you either have to use the local council courts, magistrate's court, or high court, depending on the value of the land. So I implore all people that are facing evictions to also use and utilize this mechanism, these national mechanisms. Use your district land boards, use your Ministry of Land zonal offices, use even these other courts of judicature, because they help us get redress. Thank you.
Okay. How accessible is justice for ordinary people, especially those in remote areas or without financial means?
Thank you very much, Stephen, for that question. If I may get your question, it's in regards to access to justice. However, before we delve into that question, I recently spoke about the Ministry of Land Zonal Offices. In terms of that, the Ministry of Land Zonal Offices, majorly, it was created to distribute the administration of land. I would advise the communities that in Uganda specifically, we do hold land under four tenures, which is leasehold, customary tenure, milo tenure, and freehold tenure. And the Ministry of Land Zonal Offices is majorly as a point of registration. That's why, like, you register your land as an individual. Most of us are facing evictions today because our land is not registered. And yet, we do have Ministry of Land Zonal Offices. The registration procedures are not hard, most especially when it comes to customary certificate of ownership. It will cost someone about 10,000 shillings. So, of course, when you're to look into other land tenures, which is milo, leasehold, and freehold, because it requires a survey, it will cost a little bit more. So people should engage in land registration, because you see, the ministry itself could barely protect you if you're not registered. And they say that when you're registered, when you have a certificate of title, it surely shows that you're the legal owner. So you have a legal right over that land. So I implore most of the communities to visit their zonal offices, their Ministry of Land zonal offices. So, and then your second question was, how accessible is justice to these communities? First and foremost, I think I want to give a round of applause to the Ministry of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, which is also part of Judicial Service Commission. There have been different courts of laws within the different districts. Where there is no high court, at least there will be a chief magistrate's court, which is accessible to these communities. So even in areas where you least expect to find court, at least the distance to court is not as, you know, very hefty. It could be about maybe 20 kilometers, 15 kilometers for a person to access court. But aside of that, let us also look into these local council courts at sub-county level, because there is a local council 3 court at sub-county level. People should utilize these courts, most especially when it comes to matters of customary tenure, because local council courts only have jurisdiction over customary tenure. And when it's not something to do with customs, then it has to go to the chief magistrate's court or the high court. So in my opinion, justice is accessible. However, how knowledgeable are these community members that are faced with such challenges? Mm-hmm. I think there is a bit of a challenge when it comes to the knowledge gap, and which surely should be done by the, you know, Judicial Service Commission, because that is their role as Judicial Service Commission, to dispense justice. So you cannot dispense justice to an ignorant person. Much as lawyers are also there, but lawyers are expensive. Because for someone to sit with you even for 30 minutes, they will charge you heftily to give you information, because that is a that they're giving you technical information and they are going to charge for that. So I think also there is a gap between the communities and the Judicial Service Commission, which I think I implore that the Judicial Service Commission should come in and fill that gap in terms of knowledge, in terms of sensitization about these judicial processes. And surely they have also tried to work around sensitization, most especially when it comes to court opening day.
Yes, you talked of land registration, in other words, having land titles, and you have seen communities evicted or people evicted with the titles. How should justice be possible if victors are appearing to be strong and untouchable?
Thank you so much, Stephen, for that follow-up question. One way, or one of the most temporary ways to prevent land evictions and shift from proprietorship from one person to another, is by caveating your land. So usually when you have a land title, it is always good to caveat it. What do I mean by caveating it? It is form of a protective mechanism for a landowner or for a person that has a certificate of title. And in addition to that, that because it is temporarily really used, because a caveat only lasts 60 days, about 2 months here in Uganda, under the laws of Uganda. However, where the evictor is tending to be stronger than, you know, the person that has the land, that is now when we look at other pressure points. For example, who is behind the evictions? It is always also good to do a little bit of research before you actually, you know, go into court and stuff like this. Because you may even sue a wrong person. And of course, you'll be charged for that. Why would you sue somebody wrongly? But let us also encourage people or community members that have land titles. And one of the challenges that I have with a customary certificate of ownership is because it is not really... It is recognized, yes, under the laws of Uganda, but because it does not have a folio and a plot number, it is not measured, it is not like surveyed per se, you cannot have it in the systems. And surely those are also very prone to eviction, because it is not something that you can easily look up in the system and you get it, in the Ministry of Land system, and you get it. Mm. The only land that you can look up in the system and get is surveyed land. Mm. And of which, under surveyed land, we are only going to get 3 titles, which is freehold, leasehold, and milo.
Wow, okay. Thank you so much, Councillor Sarah, for this wonderful breakdown. We are taking a break, and when we come back, Councillor Joanne will tell us why cases drag on for so much time in court.
Witness Radio, where your voice is a weapon. Justice for all. That's our guarantee. Tune in today. Witness Radio, shining the light.
Listen to Witness Radio to stay up to date on breaking news about land evictions in Uganda.
Farmers, do you want to learn essential agricultural practices and benefit from your land? Look no further. Tune in to Witness Radio for expert knowledge and guidance.
Thanks to everyone for tuning to this wonderful and educative show. I am Stephen Mwiri with my 2 guests, Councillor Joanne and Sarah. I also want to remind you that these tutorials are being sponsored by IZ3W and SEZ, all organizations based in Germany. And this is the last episode. Now we go to Joanne. We've also seen many land cases drag on for years, sometimes without clear resolution. What are some of the biggest legal or procedural barriers that prevent these cases from moving forward?
Thank you, Stephen, for that question. Actually, that has really been a very big challenge in Uganda here, because you find that in most cases, people are actually, it takes long, you know, to get justice. And then at the last moment, you find people have given up, you know, like you take a case in court and it lasts something like 5 years. And to make matters worse, you find that the investors keep doing their work, you know, because you find that they've already evicted people and maybe people want compensation and all that. So the one of the reasons as to why actually they drag cases in court, the first thing is, you know, the judiciary in Uganda here, the level of independence is really questionable. So, and you know, the country values investors more than even we, the citizens of Uganda. So to some extent, it comes to a point where the judiciary is compromised in a way. And you find that because they wouldn't want to put it straight to the affected people to know that maybe there is compromise and everything, you may find that the judge will keep on dragging a case, adjourning it here and there every time. But yet at the back of, you know, their mind, they know very well is maybe there is an order, maybe from above, that, you know, you don't have to hear that case, or you have to dismiss it, or you give us time to sort things out, things like that. So that has really dragged a lot of cases, you know. And then the other thing that drags a lot of cases is, some of them are very costly, and these, you find that the people that are mostly affected with land evictions are very poor people. And the pro bono services are there, but they are very few. You get? And even some of them do not even know where to get their pro bono services. So you find that it is very, they find it very expensive to actually, you know, process the thing, go back to court every time, here and there, you get. So that is one of the reasons as to why you see people that are trying to support those people, we are resorting to redress mechanisms where they'll say within a year, like their time frames, within a year, a case is done, you know, so that, you know, people get justice, other than waiting for 5 years, a case to be heard only in vain, and people get tired, and yet the company keeps on investing and making money at the expense of, you know, the vulnerable people. Yes, so thank you.
Just to add on Joanne's voice, it has also come to my attention that there is a high level of promotion of globalization, where we see a difference between these African countries and, of course, other countries, let's say the superpowers of the world. And with that, even banks financing these projects, they have, they're pushing the agenda of globalization. And of course, in the African market, we do really a lot of agriculture. And we find that this globalization has put us at a disadvantage as countries within Africa, and, you know, some other countries like South America. So we are at a disadvantage because we are being manipulated. So with that, you find that even within a project, the investor has an interest, different interest, or is serving a different interest. The bank is also serving a different interest. By the bank, I mean a bank that is financing that project. It also has its different interest. So it is even at a very big disadvantage for these communities, because surely now you do not know where to run to. You can find that as an investor, there are several agreements that they have, you know, they have made with the different entities within the country and without the country. So you find that with the bank, the investor has a different trade agreement. Even the other side, within our country, let's say the Uganda Investment Authority, the investor also has a different investment agreement with the country. So you find that as a community, you're very much disadvantaged, because you do not know what is in this information. You do not know how to even go about certain situations when they come to you, because there wasn't there were no consultative processes.
Even when court ruling favors communities, enforcement is often another battle. Evictions continue, investors proceed with projects, and officials turn a blind eye. Still to you, Sarah, from a legal point of view, what are the obligations of government institutions, such as the lands ministry, district officials, in protecting community land rights?
Thank you, Stephen. Like I had earlier on shared, most of the districts, Ministry of Lands has distributed administrative justice to the different districts by creating Ministry of Lands zonal offices. Zonal offices, which means we are bringing administration of land justice closer to the people. When you look at the district land boards and Ministry of Lands, one thing they have in common is to, you know, facilitate land registration, transfers, conducting surveys of land. And yes, of course, when your land is registered, you're protected as an individual. in Uganda, under the laws of Uganda, you're protected. Specifically, I think under the Registration of Titles Act, you're protected. Also, when you look at another obligation that the District Land Board has is to, you know, hold, allocate public land to the people. By public land, what do I mean? This is land that that one can offer, you know, can you make an offer to the government of Uganda to get a lease on it? Because on public land, we can only get leases. We cannot, you know, own it because it doesn't belong to the government, but the government holds it in trust for the people of Uganda or for the citizens of Uganda. So, yes. They are also important in protecting, you know, community land rights, because when a community member registers their land, that means they are protected. However, when you also look at the district leadership, for example, the residential district commissioner, the police, those are the first administrative, you know, tables that one should approach when there is a land eviction in a community, because Ministry of Lands will not move from Kampala, let's say, to Arua. No, there is always the first desk that you have to go to. Now, for example, police, you bring it to the knowledge of police. Then, because they are there to protect you, as you know, as citizens of Uganda, the police has an obligation to protect you as a citizen of Uganda. And even during evictions, it still has a right to, I mean, an obligation to protect you, because that is one of their biggest mandate or primary mandate, as you know, Uganda police. When you also look at the resident district commissioner, this is a person in charge of security. Most of the land evictions come with more of insecurity. People are being criminalized, charges slapped on them, their deaths. Some of them even come as hefty as tear gas, you know, usage of tear gas, usage of, you know, live bullets within the communities. And these are the first desks that, you know, the community should be approaching.
Okay. Yeah, that's nice. Why do we see so many cases where these institutions fail to act or even side with investors despite clear violations of the law?
I'll start with the Constitution of Uganda. Under Article 20, it stipulates for equality. And of course, there is no one above the law. That is true. However, we see that there has been a lack of implementation of that article. And yet, it is not even a right given to us by the Constitution, by virtue of the fact that we were born, we were supposed to be equal entirely. That article is not being implemented so well, and that's why we see such challenges. But one of the reasons I could say that, the different entities or the different, you know, government entities side with the investor is because of, first and foremost, the Uganda Investment Authority is always going to protect the investor at all costs. And also, when you look at our Investment Code Act, it says that the government shall always make land available to the investor. Land is like one of the biggest means of production in Uganda. And that is what the government of Uganda can offer best. But why do we support the investors? It's because we... Previously, like I explained, the different entities do have different interests, and everybody has to protect their interest, yes. You know. And secondly, is sometimes even the investor is just a face of a bigger investment than we actually think. There is undercover information that the community probably does not know, and neither do we know as civil society organizations. So you find that it is even hard to even think that, you know, the government would side with them. But sometimes it's because of the different, you know, different interests of various people within the project. Secondly, it's also sometimes when you're impoverished, there is a way society looks at you. We have realized that most of the communities that are infected, there is a knowledge gap, first of all, in terms of land rights. There is also a knowledge gap in terms of these projects. They are fighting with what they actually do not know.
Now, let's go for a short break. When we return, we shall look at what people or civil societies can do to hold government or officials accountable who fail to do their responsibilities.
Every day, every hour, tune in to Witness Radio, your number one choice. Witness Radio is the voice of the people. Listen to the power.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices. Witness Radio, your number one choice.
Yes, thank you. Welcome back from the short break. Before we went for the break, Council Sarah was talking about the government officials who disregard fulfilling their responsibilities, like not protecting local communities, and instead protect the investors. Now, Council Joan, when government bodies neglect their duties or delay justice, what can communities or civil societal groups do to hold them accountable? And are there existing legal tools or advocacy channels that actually work?
Thank you for that question. When we look at the government delaying to carry out its obligations, what civil society organizations have done, the first thing they do is usually you may find that there are legal procedures that you know are laid out at a national level, but you find that there are gaps in those civil, you know, those laws or policies that you know maybe the government may come up with, you know. So the civil society organizations, what they basically do, this is the first thing to do, is to make sure they notify the government of the gaps that are missing, you know, and maybe the amendments in the law and in one way or another, to see that everybody is covered, you know, in the policies or the laws that we have that govern people's rights. It could be land rights or any other right. So the first thing we do is, we make sure that, you know, we let it know of the gaps. Like, we have to engage the government and let them know that there is a gap that needs to be fixed. Then the other challenge that we have, or the other solution that we usually do, is at a national level, we may not have the solutions, or we may not be, if we fail to convince or to force the government to actually see that maybe they carry out the obligation, is what we do is we resort to the international, maybe international redress mechanisms or international ways of how to make sure we force the government to actually carry out its obligations. Because now Uganda has signed a lot of treaties with at an international level, which treaties they must abide by. So if we see that at the national level, the laws are not being respected, then there is a time where Council Sarah was talking about the pressure points. So that is when now we have to involve any, at an international level, who can we engage that could be a pressure point to see that the government of Uganda is obligated, you know, to respect or to carry out its obligations as a government.
Yeah, and looking at the private sector, to you, Sarah, what should responsible investors be doing to ensure their business activities do not lead to human rights violations?
Thank you very much, Stephen, for that question. Private investors, you see that the difference between a community member and the private sector is the private sector looks at the profit that it's going to get out of its investment. And yet, the community, that is not how they think. They think that much as this project is going to come in our community, we still need to, you know, sit down and agree on certain things before we actually host the project in our community. So much as private sectors are more of profit oriented, I think before even they start looking into where to invest, how to invest, they should be able first and foremost to follow the Ugandan laws. There is a law on land acquisition procedure. There is a land act that we have. We have the constitution, which actually enables them to acquire this land that they want to invest in without, you know, causing a lot of human rights violations. Secondly, I would think that much as they would follow the law, can they also involve the community from the initial stages of the project? By the initial stages, what do I mean? When you have realized that this is where you want to invest, engage the community, because this is going to be the host community. And an investor or as, you know, the private sector, I do not think that with the back and forth of lawsuits, with the back and forth of, you know, international accountability mechanisms, you're able to actually do business right. You actually also make losses. So if you want to do things right, I believe that the community should be engaged at the initial stages of the project.
Just to supplement on what Councilor Sarah was saying, we all believe that all these investments, when they come to Uganda, they all talk about we are coming to develop the country. So when community members see such investments coming, they expect development, because it's not like every investment that is going to come is going to evict people and leave, you know, the land with only the investment going on. Some of these investments take just a piece of land, and then there are community members that still stay in the community. So it would be for something to look beautiful, you know, when an investment is happening in a community, let it develop the community, let people feel its presence, let them feel its importance, you know, let them feel, yeah, it was good for this project to come or for this investment to come in our community, you get. So it would be very good for investors to know that whenever they are trying to invest in a given community, let them try to change the lives of the people they are found there. Let them construct schools. Let them have construct hospitals. Make life a bit easier than it was, so that people are able to welcome, you know, the project. But the saddest bit of it is most of them, when they come, they actually leave the community members in a worse state than they were. That is why you see that a lot of people are fighting investors in one or another. Otherwise, we wouldn't be going to that direction of, you know, now this investment, we wouldn't be fighting them, you know, reporting cases to court and all that. If they were actually doing something that was very fruitful to the community members.
On top of what our colleague Joanne has shared with us, I think I also need to share that usually these investors have the resettlement action plans, and these resettlement action plans are formulated in boardrooms. They have not engaged the community to actually, you know, speak about their own resettlement. So the community is exclusive of the preliminary stages of usually the project, because if you come up with a resettlement plan that you think is going to work for me, surely, and yet it is not going to work, why wouldn't you involve me, you know, in the process? Because I am the most affected person. Why wouldn't you involve the community? So I think they should also start involving the community. But also it goes back to the financiers. As a financier, you see, when such projects are coming in on board, you need to also be human rights sensitive, that in this where this project is going to be based, aren't there people living there? There should be some due diligence that is done by the financier before it even gives, you know, the private sector money or even the investor money to, you know, implement the project, to support the investor. There should be some due diligence from the banks that are financing these projects, because at the end of the day, they are the ones making losses. We are going to go to their accountability mechanisms, make complaints. They have to fly in people, mediators. I know that is little money for them, but it also constrains, you know, the investment. So the financiers should also look, it should be human rights sensitive in terms when they are financing these projects, that in that, even if they are to give you money, there should be some conditions attached to that money.
Thanks, Councilor Sarah. We are going for a short break now. Councilor Joanne will talk about informed consent when we come back and what it means in responsible investment.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices. Witness Radio, your number one choice.
Farmers, do you want to learn essential agriculture practices and benefit from your land? Look no further. Tune in to Witness Radio for expert knowledge and guidance.
If you want to tune into Witness Radio, go to Play Store on your phone, type Witness Radio. You will see the application, download it, and start listening to Witness Radio. You can also visit our website on www.witnessradio.org. Click live on your PC's right hand, then click the button in the middle. Then listen to Witness Radio and learn all issues about land and environmental protection.
Right, okay. Welcome back. Thanks for tuning to Witness Radio. Let's shift focus to investors, because not all investment is harmful. When done responsibly, it can benefit communities, but that requires listening and respecting local rights. So back to you, Joan. We often hear about principle of free, prior and informed consent, or FPIC, especially in international human rights frameworks. What does FPIC mean in practice, and how can it help protect communities in Uganda?
Thank you very much, Stephen. One of the challenges we have faced, we who are actually dealing or trying to help out or provide support to victims of land evictions, is the fact that most of the investors do not actually, they do not consult the community. They do not approach the community. Or probably when they are trying to actually get land, you know, to carry out their investments, they do not even know what is on land at a certain point, because Councillor Sarah was talking about the due diligence. They do not do that, you know. So that has really become a challenge, where them, the fact that they do not consult, they do not even talk to the community, they do not engage them, like she was talking about the resettlement action plan, you know. So the community is not engaged in all that. So when we talk about what that means, or the prior and informed consent, it means that when the investors are coming in the community, they must consult the community, they must involve them, you know, they must engage them, they must ask, sensitize them. They'll be like, now, you know, we have a project that is coming, let's say an agricultural project, you know, we want to start producing, you know, maybe planting maize in your community. You have to go and talk to the people, you know, for those whose land, that maybe if there are squatters or if there are people that are owning land, find a way of how to compensate them. And adequate compensation per the laws of Uganda, not just, you know, having blockers who are going to come with tear gas and police, and then you just chase people anyhowly. So you must follow the law of acquisition of land. You get, how does it move? Consult the people. It is, tell if you're taking their land, talk to them, do the valuation. What do you have on land? How big is your land? You get, compensate people adequately so that they can be able to go wherever they want to go. For those that are staying on land, involve them. Because some, at a certain point, some of those committee members also have things that they want an investor to at least contribute to the development of the community. You get, tell them, they'll tell you, okay, you construct for us a school, establish a borehole to make their life easier, or a hospital somewhere. Let them be involved in all those things. Change their livelihoods in one or another. How does it look like? You get, for those that are staying. And then, like I said, if it's going to endanger, notify them. So let them be okay with the project, not to feel like you are coming to, you know, try to kind of destroy their livelihood or their life and all that, or to make them more poorer than they were.
Most of the mechanisms we have talked about are judicial, using courts of law to get justice. Are there other non-judicial mechanisms that can be used to hold investors accountable for violating people or community rights?
There are non-judicial mechanisms that we that can actually be utilized to make sure that people get justice. Where now, like, yeah, apparently right now what we do is we do corporate research on who is funding a certain project or an investment, and then probably there are those different banks, you know, or they could be maybe those different banks have different redress mechanisms that we file complaints to, you get, when in case they fund a project here and it is violating people's human rights. So we engage them, or we file a complaint to them, and all the community members can do it directly, or ICSO can file a complaint, you know, to those different redress mechanisms for different banks. You get, to let them know that actually the project you're funding is actually violating people's human rights. And usually what they do, most of them usually have two options. There's either a dispute resolution, or they do an investigation, which is a compliance, to see, because if you let them know, they would want to know. So it depends on the community. Some of them would say, let us settle this thing through mediation. Like, we settle with the investor, and maybe they can compensate us or agree on certain things. They come up with an agreement. And if it doesn't work, then the funders or the banks, of course, will send some people to do investigations and maybe caution, you know, the investors and let them know that, yes, we are giving you money, but we are bound by certain rules for business and human rights, where you have to respect people's human rights as you're carrying out this business. So aside the judicial mechanisms, yeah, we have, it's just that now this that we are talking about at an international level or not at a national level. Some people have even also complained to the Human Rights Commission in one or another, you know, and it has been able to settle some matters. So aside judicial, we have some other mechanisms that you can use to make sure that people get, you know, justice. But like now for WRI, yes, we have, so far we have used the inspection panel complaint mechanism, the World Bank Inspection Panel complaint mechanism, and we were able to get justice for Kawala people. Apparently, we are using also the COW, the Compliance Advisory Ombudsman, you know, to make sure that we get justice for a certain community in Chiriandongo. So yeah, aside that, there are other alternatives. But it's just that by the time you go to those other redress mechanisms, especially now, like the filing a complaint to the bank, you must have exhausted all the national redress mechanisms. Yeah, even the court itself, you must have gone there and you failed to get justice.
One of another channel that the community should really engage in using is the Equal Opportunities Commission. The Equal Opportunities Commission also deals with civil matters that are civil in nature, that do not have charges like the criminal. So in terms of land evictions, land grabs, those are all civil matters that the Equal Opportunities Commission can attend to. And it also comes free of charge, really. You do not have to pay any money for your matter to be attended to.
Okay, right. And finally, this is to you both. If you were to speak directly to investors listening to this program, what message would you give them about doing business responsibly and respecting human dignity?
As a responsible investor, you're profit-oriented. And I think before you carry on any business, you should have done due diligence as a person. Because more so, if your means of production is going to be land, you need to identify one. But also now, after identification, can you do due diligence on that land to actually say, to know what are some of the implications or the costs that you will bear to acquire that land? Secondly, I think as an investor, you need to involve, there should be an inclusive engagement between you and the what? And the community. Because this is a community that is going to host your investment. So, and I think you want the investment to be very much welcomed within the community. Because if there is coexistence between that business and the community, it makes work easier for the both of you. You will get cheap labor. That is the first reason. But also, it will be easier for you because you do not have to go to court back and forth. You do not have to redress issues back and forth. The third thing that I would say really is, as you come up with these projects as an investor, can we have a redress mechanism that is functional? Because most of the time when these projects come in place, there should be a redress mechanism, because with an investment comes a challenge. It could either be to the investment itself or to the community member. And for the investments that we have seen, I think the community member is the most affected person. And they should have functional, partial, and very liberal redress mechanisms within their projects. They should create those channels of redressing problems that are faced during, post, even at the initial process of implementing that investment.
Thank you, Councillor Sarah. This is more of just throwing, it's more of emphasizing, because one of the reasons as to why we have investors and communities having issues is the investors never consult. They never engage community members at any cost. All they do is, you know, because you know the we have backup from the government, all they do is to just evict people anyhowly. So Councillor Sarah said most of the things that are very important for an investor to be in a community without any disturbance or interference. But emphasis is they should engage the community so that they get to know, the community gets to know the kind of investment that is coming. Second, they must make sure they follow the national laws, especially in regards to acquisition of land. It is very, very important for them to know, you know, that we have national laws that also govern us, not for them to be, you know, coming and they feel like they're gods, like they're above the law.
Well, that brings us to the end of our 3-part audio tutorial series on protecting community land rights against investor interests. We have traveled through the causes of land conflicts, the human stories of displacement, and now the path towards justice and accountability. Until next time, I'm Stephen, reminding you that land is life, and protecting it is protecting our dignity, our heritage, and our future. Bye-bye for now.